You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
But Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God."
Welcome to By the Well, everybody. It's Pentecost 23, and I'm here today with the Reverend Rachel Kronberger. Hello, Rachel. Thank you for joining By the Well again.
Hi, Fran. It's great to be here.
For those of you who don't remember Rachel, she's a Uniting Church minister currently in placement at Yarraville Uniting Church. So this week, Rachel, Pentecost 23, we'll be focusing indeed on Ruth, chapter 1, verse 1 to 18, a brief foray into Psalm 146, and Mark 12, 28 to 34. And it is also the week of the Communion of Saints. So a number of you may wish to remember that in your preparation and your services for this week, although it falls on the Monday. So, Rachel, the book of Ruth, 5th century, quite a late story. We've got wonderful word plays going on at the level of the detail level here, haven't we, in this story?
So many great word plays.
Okay. Why do you like the book of Ruth?
Oh, I love it. It's such a crafted story. It has so many layers. It's political, it's emotional, it's fantastic storytelling, and it's deeply challenging. It has its own role. Ruth turns up in Matthew's genealogy of Jesus as a woman who, though not even Jewish, demonstrates God's loving kindness and is therefore brought into a central role in the big picture of the people of Israel.
Yeah, very important book and woman. So we've got 2 weeks on it, haven't we? So let's start with the text. So I've already mentioned it's quite a late book, so after the exile. And we begin within the days when the judges ruled, very loaded. Every statement here will be loaded, I think we'll find. But if you go to Judges 21:25, you will see a reference to what life was like when the judges ruled, and it was not good. Israel was troubled. And I think it says something like, "And everyone did what they wanted," which didn't work out for the community as a whole. So here we're beginning with famine.
Yeah. And famine in Bethlehem, the house of bread. This is the trouble is not only among the people, but the trouble with the land itself.
Yeah. And Moab, that's a despised nation according to Israel.
Yes, born of the fruit of Lot and his daughters, fruit of incest, and despised and really, you know, moving towards disgusting, I think.
Yeah, and we must note here that Ruth is not mentioned just as Ruth in this story. She's Ruth the Moabite, so that the narrator or the storyteller is absolutely making it unambiguous.
The Moabite from the land of Moab.
Yep. Outsider.
Yeah.
In every sense.
Yeah, so the famine in the house of bread in Bethlehem is the first great wordplay here because emptiness and fullness and famine and abundance are such a strong theme throughout the whole book of Ruth. So so things were so desperate in Bethlehem that Naomi and Elimelech and their sons Mahlon and Chilion left Bethlehem to live in Moab.
And even in their names we get an indication of their character. So Chilion, for example, is puny and weak.
Yeah, Mahlon is sickly.
Right.
It's not looking good
for
those boys.
It's not looking good at all. And yeah. Elimelech also indicates.
Well, his name can be translated as "God is my king," but the story begins with him being called a certain man, which suggests that he's, I don't know about a baddie, but certainly not the hero of the story.
He has a reputation.
Yeah. Perhaps an act of faithlessness to leave Bethlehem in its time of need.
So the theme of famine continues enormously in the next few verses because everybody dies except for Naomi. And she's left with two sons who get Moabite wives. one of whom is Ruth and Orpah. And when they'd been living there for 10 years, those men died.
That's right. So then three women are left, three widows, each with their own struggles and challenges. Naomi sees that the younger women perhaps have a future because they might be able to remarry and have children. She feels desperate that her life is effectively over.
Yeah, which in that culture it was. I mean, you're alone in the world with no brother or husband or father. I'm struck at the moment. I'm indulging some of my lockdown time by watching a Netflix series called Maid, which is very 21st century, but it's following the story of a young woman who is from a dysfunctional background, you know, lots of troubles in the family. She splits from her partner, has a small child. You know, I'm watching it thinking of Ruth's story, wondering what's changed. I mean, I know things have changed, but this woman in Maid, she's got no job, no money. She's trying to negotiate a social security system that's pitted against her in every way. And
she's almost as bereft.
She's as bereft as yeah. Ruth, really. Yeah. Anyway, back to the text.
Back to the text. So Naomi urges her daughters-in-law to go back to their mothers. To their mother's houses, which strongly suggests, with a view to remarrying, that go back to your mother's houses so that they can arrange another marriage,
another future,
for you,
yeah.
And another a new future for you. And she decides to return to her home and her kin in Bethlehem.
And that mother's house phrase is not used very commonly biblically. Normally we hear about father's houses.
That's right. Rebecca's mother's house is mentioned in Genesis, and the mother's house comes up twice in the Song of Songs. But, yeah, just here in Ruth is the only other time.
And, of course, we know that, Orpah decides, you know, does as Naomi asks and returns. And I suppose what's important to highlight here, I think, is that there's no judgment of Orpah at this point. She's just followed custom and the older woman's instruction.
That's right.
But we know Naomi absolutely, she refuses.
Ruth refuses to go back.
I mean, Ruth refuses to go back, sorry.
Yeah.
Getting my
yeah.
Ruths and Naomi's mixed up.
And when Ruth refuses, she doesn't just refuse. She steps into the fullness of everything that she has, and she has a right to make a binding oath as a widow, and so that's what she does here with Naomi. Her speech, which is a gift of poetry that pervades our culture with such, you know, you might have heard it used as a wedding vow or another kind of commitment. I often think of these words when I see older people caring for one another, you know, after having made a covenant of marriage in their early 20s, you know, seeing them in their 90s in pastoral ministry still holding on to this sort of depth of commitment.
Yeah, yeah.
So she makes this binding oath to stick by and to care for Naomi forever. And she recognises God in, and this is really God's big appearance in
yeah,
this week's
we haven't
reading.
Said that God's got a very bit part in this book.
But she recognises Naomi's faith and adopts it for herself, and she makes covenant with Naomi to stand by her and to never leave her.
Can you say any more about the fact that widows had a right to make a binding oath? I'm wondering whether that's something why?
Well, there's not many entitlements. The entitlements for women are a bit limited, I think, in the ancient world generally. So a father would speak for his daughter, a husband would speak for his wife. But in a situation where there is a widow who has been married, that she is able to represent her own family.
Yeah, right. I see. One thing I would want to emphasise too in this part of the story or just before it is Naomi's naming of her own suffering. So we've just come off the back of several weeks on Job, which is, you know, that book par excellence in the Hebrew scriptures about inexplicable suffering insofar as any of it's explicable, but, you know, real lostness in the face of God. Yeah. And she talks about her bitterness
And if we read, if you, I would encourage you to use the whole of chapter one if you have space in your worship, because we, when Naomi arrives in Bethlehem at the end of chapter one, she says, no longer call me Naomi, which means sweet, call me Mara, which means bitter.
Yeah, yeah.
So she deeply acknowledges that that suffering, and she's been stripped of everything that her world gives her in terms of her identity. She's no longer wife. She's no longer mother. She has everything taken away from her as she sees it, and so she has to begin again to learn who she is and to whom she belongs.
And that's what's so remarkable too about Ruth's commitment, because yes, she's lost those things as well, but she then is willing to give up her gods. We're not told who her gods may or God may have been. But she had most, 99% of them had a god.
Yeah.
And she's willing to give up that as well for the sake of...
Oh, she gives up language, culture, home, family, religion, gives everything up for Naomi.
In my preaching of this text, I would want to emphasise the clung to her in verse 14, that Ruth clung to Naomi, and the echoes with Genesis 22:24 about the husband and wife and the one flesh.
Yeah.
That covenant language again from that story coming through even in that verse before we hear Ruth's words.
But it's such powerful emotional language. And this act of giving of Naomi lost so many of her identifiers in the deaths of her husband and sons, but partly because she was isolated from her land and culture and language.
Mm.
But Ruth gives up those things voluntarily and chooses to identify solely with Naomi, with her people, with her God. And in this act of unconditional commitment, Ruth reveals God's chesed, his loving kindness, and is an exemplar of the faith, even as an outsider.
Yeah. I also think of Job's friends. Like I think a preaching possibility for this text is that loving kindness of God that is experienced through others, through people, and yep. people's going out of their way for one another in times of tragedy. But you've got Job's friends, and well-meaning, but they're terrible rationale or reasons why Job was suffering. And this is a contrast, very much a contrast,
such a contrast.
Response
yeah.
to a suffering one alongside you.
Let me stand beside you and give you everything that I have. And it's interesting, I have read about this, but I've never heard it, I don't know if you have, Fran, about daughters-in-law being told to be more like Ruth and to do everything their mother-in-law tells them.
No, I haven't, but I can imagine that exists, yes.
Want to be cautious about the misuse of this reading. People giving up everything has to be something that they choose for themselves. It cannot be something that is ever imposed on another.
Yeah, absolutely. So the psalm selected for today, Psalm 146, it's fairly unambiguous why this pairing has occurred.
The Lord watches over the strangers. He upholds the orphan and the widow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One point I'd make is that verse 3 in this psalm seems to contradict what's happening in the text. That is, it says, "Do not put your trust in princes, in mortals in whom there is no help."
Although they haven't been cared for by their community leaders.
That's
They're
true.
Completely on their own.
That's
they don't,
true. Yeah.
The state hasn't provided for them any more than in the Netflix show you've been watching.
Yeah. No. True.
But I would see this more that Ruth's actions align again with God's actions here. Ruth is caring for Naomi, the widow, even though she herself is a widow, she is enacting God's care for Naomi. So in preaching, we might wonder about our identity, when everything's stripped away. And in COVID times, a lot has been stripped away from us as individuals and as churches, and what that now means, how we can discover who we are as the people of God and as children of God without some of those structures and things that have perhaps been lost over the last couple of years.
I think that's a really fruitful direction to take a sermon in, using Ruth, actually. That's, be good if people could write on the Facebook comments or something if they end up preaching along those lines and how people responded.
Yeah.
Is there anything more that you wanted to highlight in the psalm, Rachel, before we move on to Mark?
No, I don't think so. But I think there's a suggestion in the psalm that that God works alone in caring for the vulnerable, but we see how crucial it is for us to participate in God's work in caring for those who are vulnerable among us.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find the link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
So we're racing ahead in the lectionary year, and we have Mark 12 before us today, verse 28 onwards, and Jesus' encounter with the scribe and the conversation about the greatest commandment and loving your neighbour. This passage comes off the back of quite a bit of questioning of Jesus by Jewish authorities, chief priests, scribes and elders, and the passage immediately preceding this is his argument, Jesus' argument with the Sadducees around the belief in the resurrection, which they didn't believe in. And the scribe, we learn here, must be a Pharisee, because in the first verse of this passage, the scribe says, seeing that Jesus answered them well, the Sadducees, we can presume he's a Pharisee.
I love that bit because someone's been eavesdropping and they've appreciated Jesus' line of argument and they're curious about what he thinks, and they really they're seeking him out as a colleague, as a debating partner,
yeah,
as a person of authority, and it's such a rich lead into this conversation.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent summary. Like, I think perhaps this passage is it's expressed in Matthew might dominate in people's thinking, where Matthew adds that the scribes come to test Jesus. That's not what's happening here in Mark at all. And as you say, it's a genuine conversation to tussle with the truth, and where the truth might be between two colleagues, or fellow temple dwellers, or however you might put it.
Yeah.
And that actually already is a fabulous preaching direction to go in with this. How do we tussle with the scriptures? How do we disagree? How do we refine how we talk about the faith and our place in it?
And how do we listen deeply to one another and really keep our minds open to a curiosity about how others feel and how others respond to scripture among us?
Yeah, so this also then is an opportunity to really preach against any anti-Semitism that people that you may have heard or absorbed, that as if loving the neighbour didn't exist in Jewish law, obviously.
That comes in a few different layers. If you have access to the Jewish Annotated New Testament, there's a great essay by Michael Fagenblatt at the end of the
We'll put a link in the show notes of that.
Of that book about the concept of neighbour in Jewish and Christian ethics. And he says it's a misunderstanding to think that neighbour in Judaism always refers to fellow Jews, that it is an idea that is often expanded, or at least sometimes expanded, to include much broader context. So it's not a Christian invention of the love of Jew and Gentile. But he also says it's important to note that Jesus doesn't say that the love of God and neighbour replaces the commandments, but that it is the most important, so that it is a lens through which the law is read. It's a way into the law, a way into the law that emphasises the gift of relationship and community rather than rule-keeping, which is an emphasis that Jesus brings throughout his teaching. But it's important to speak respectfully of Jewish law when we speak about this passage.
And that's actually very subtly, perhaps to us, alluded to in verse 30, where Jesus adds to the Deuteronomy text, that you should love your Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. So Jesus adds with all your mind here, which I do think is another nice thing to highlight when you're talking about healthy debate, fruitful listening, and seeking the truth together.
Yeah.
Especially when we do live in a context where a lot of thoughtful or expert, there's a lot of rejection of thoughtful and expert advice and knowledge.
There is. And
in our world.
Yeah, yeah. There is. And I've also, I have heard, though not read for myself, that Augustine was a big fan of this strategy for reading scripture to test our own interpretations of the whole of scripture with the question of how it reflects love of God and neighbour, and how we seek out those truths in whatever it is we're reading in scripture.
There's also a relationship highlighted here about the loving the neighbour and the relationship for that kind of commandment to the rituals of religious life.
Yeah.
So in verse 33, this is much more important than a whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. So we've encountered this before, of course, in the texts around does your ethics conform to what you – are you doing as you say?
Yeah.
Or are you just – going through motions. But I think this has sometimes been shallowly read as if the sacrifices and burnt offerings aren't important at all, and that would be an anachronistic judgment to make of this text, because no Jewish person or indeed non-Jew at the time would conceive of religious life without sacrifice.
No, that's
right. And offerings, animal sacrifice.
And so we might ask ourselves, what are the equivalents for us? What do we... what are our religious practices, our practices of our communities of faith, which become very, very important to us, and do they maintain their place below the importance of love of God and neighbour, however important they become to us? And, in different communities are vulnerable in different ways to placing things in priority above love of God and neighbour, and we each have to ask ourselves, and preaching's a great opportunity to ask those questions.
And also a great opportunity to point out when we're inconsistent. So we've been talking about this being an opportunity to preach about listening, debate, dialogue, learning, mutuality, but the reality is the church lives in massive division.
Yeah.
between denominations, but also within denominations about key and not key issues, how do we reconcile that reality with this call on us?
Yeah, and there's a lovely podcast I've listened to one episode of called The Principle of Charity, in which two people are brought on with opposing views are asked to articulate at the beginning of their contribution the most generous version of their debating opponent's point of view that they can. And it requires of each person that they read and reflect on and think about the other person's point of view before they speak about what they themselves think. And it's such a rich idea, but I hear the principle of charity, if we in modern Christian language we might talk about the principle of love, which is at the heart of this passage in Mark, and think about how do we listen to one another in love within our communities?
I've just realised that we mentioned that it's the Communion of Saints festival this week, and we haven't referred to that in our readings this week, and it's nearly time to wrap up. Is there one of the passages in particular today in this week's setting that you would particularly draw people's attention to about that church remembrance?
Absolutely. I think Ruth and Naomi are great characters to draw on, reflecting on at the Feast of All Saints. They are among the great cloud of witnesses, of course. In their story of suffering and struggle, they witness to the presence of and blessing of God in their lives. And they show us that even when we need to cry out, I am empty or I am bitter, that we can do so still with having faith in God's love and presence, and that that there may yet be fullness ahead for us.
So I would assume then that you might preach on Ruth this week.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Couldn't resist.
Well, thanks for listening, folks. We'll join with Rachel next week for a follow-up on Ruth.
It's been great to be with you.
By the Well has been recorded on Wurundjeri land. It's produced by Adrian Jackson and brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia.